I'm Anthony Brooks in for Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Just ahead, a conversation with veteran journalist Sidney Shanberg about his friend and colleague Dith Prahn. Their story won a Pulitzer Prize and was later made into the film The Killing Fields. Dith Prahn is now sick with cancer and near death. But first, to Iraq, where an escalation of deadly violence and fighting is testing the Iraqi government's ability to take over its own national security. The crisis comes as President Bush offered a staunch defense today of U.S. progress in Iraq. In a speech in Ohio, the president rejected calls for a speedy withdrawal of U.S. troops and said the Iraqi government is succeeding despite challenging conditions. The escalating violence in Iraq is between Iraqi security forces and Shiite militias, and there's growing Shiite anger with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, who ordered the operation against the militias, which are dominated by followers of the radical cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. Tina Sussman is Baghdad bureau chief for the LA Times and joins us on a scratchy line from Baghdad. And Tina, what's going on in the Shiite-dominated city of Basra today?
Well, the latest we're hearing from Basra is that the death toll there since this fighting began is now 51. This is according to police. That's just in Basra alone. One of the main things that happened in Basra today was that a oil pipeline carrying crude down to the port there attacked, and this launched a major fire. There were no casualties reported, but the oil company there says it's going to obviously have impact on exports. People in Basra now are really beginning to feel the pinch. You know, they're saying that it's getting difficult to find food, water. There's a feeling among a lot of Basra residents that, you know, they are bearing the brunt of this violence.
Right. Tina, we know that British forces pulled out of Basra a while back. There are only a few U.S. forces there. Are the Iraqi forces capable of controlling this violence?
Well, that's the question of the century, and nobody knows the answer. I guess we'll be able to say that, depending on what the Iraqi security forces end up doing. Will they ask for intervention from the British and the American troops? Even if the Iraqi security forces are able to at least temporarily, you know, quell the violence that's been going on in Basra, throughout the rest of the country, there's, you know, rising anger about what's happening. So if you keep Basra quiet, that's one thing, but can't prevent violence from erupting or continuing to erupt in Baghdad and other population centers.
Right, and we're hearing about big protests in Sadr City, for example, in Baghdad. Shiites there frustrated and angry with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. What are followers of Muqtada al-Sadr saying? Are they making any demands?
Well, the followers of Muqtada al-Sadr in the marches today, they were basically demanding the ouster of the prime minister and repeating their, you know, now the American forces leave the country. For a long time, they've just basically been demanding that what they consider unfair offenses against their followers. You know, what's interesting about the protests that were going on today is that obviously it shows that supporters of Muqtada al-Sadr are perceiving offensive in Basra as targeting them specifically, and they simply are not hearing what the Iraqi prime minister and the U.S. government is insisting, that it's not really targeting Sadr and his supporters. It really shows just the complete disconnect between these two groups.
And you mentioned that ceasefire. Does this risk causing that ceasefire to unravel?
Oh, I think it very clearly is causing a ceasefire to unravel. I mean, some might even say it's already unraveled. Obviously, until Muqtada al-Sadr himself, you know, makes a declaration of that, though, you know, people are saying that the truce is in effect. But just sitting here in my apartment in Baghdad listening to the various rockets and mortars exploding in the neighborhood, well, to me it sounds like the truce is definitely a tightrope, you might say.
Okay, Tina, thanks so much for bringing us up to date.
Okay, thank you.
That's Tina Sussman. She's Baghdad bureau chief for the LA Times. If you saw the movie The Killing Fields about the Cambodian genocide of the 1970s, then you know who Dith Prahn is. Dith Prahn worked with New York Times correspondent Sidney Shanberg, who covered the rise of the murderous Khmer Rouge regime in Cambodia at that time. Dith Prahn saved Shanberg's life, almost lost his own, but miraculously survived years of brutality and torture at the hands of the Khmer Rouge. After 4 years, he walked across the Thai border to freedom and was eventually reunited with his friend and colleague, Shanberg. Their story won a Pulitzer Prize and was eventually made into the movie. Now Dith Pran is again battling for his life, this time in a New Jersey hospital where he is reportedly very weak and sick with stage 4 pancreatic cancer. That according to Sydney Shanberg, who joins us now from New York. And Sydney Shanberg, welcome.
It's good to be here.
And I'm sorry that your friend doesn't sound like he's faring so well. Can you tell me how he's doing?
Well, he's a fighter, and so he's still fighting against the disease. He sees it as his enemy, but the prognosis, obviously, as anybody who has had an experience with pancreatic cancer knows, the odds are very poor, and he, in recent days, has been slipping. His strength is waning.
Mm, I'm sorry. I'd like to talk to you a little bit just about his story and about how you met him. Can you just describe, first of all, how you met him
right.
And what he was like to work with in Cambodia?
Well, I met him in 1972. He was a tourist guide and interpreter, and everybody realized he was really the best possible sidekick and guide and reporter that anyone could have.
Mm. Tell us why he was the best. You said he was the best sidekick. He worked I guess it's known in the industry jargon as a sort of fixer. He was obviously much more than that.
Yeah, he did all that very well, but that's Pran, I would say most of us in the beginning didn't realize what a terrific reporter he was.
Mm.
And then what came clear to me was that Pran was really driven to tell the outside world what was happening to his people.
Mm-hmm.
That was his mission. And in a way, it was also mine, because when I came to Cambodia, nearly all of the press was in Vietnam, in the central ring of this war circus. So I really felt it was being left out, and it needed to be chronicled. A small country was being used by larger countries.
Mm-hmm.
And Pran felt the same way, and people were dying in large numbers.
I was reading a piece you wrote about those times for the New York Times back in 1980 about what it was like to work with Dith Pran, and I'm wondering if you could tell it, because it sort of explains how pushy and how competitive and how good he could be to help you get that story. And I'm referring to the story of in which an American B-52 accidentally unloaded a bunch of bombs on a heavily populated area of Cambodia. And the U.S. military wasn't exactly cooperative in helping you get that story. And you told what it was like to go up there with Dith Pran.
Right. Well, you know, the military wanted to keep all the press out of there because it was the worst bombing accident of the entire Southeast Asian war, including Vietnam. Nearly 170 people had died. When it happened on that day, there were boats coming up the Mekong from that town, Nek Lung, and bringing wounded who were being rushed into hospitals in Phnom Penh. So it was clearly not going to be kept under wraps. But they kept us away, and we found a way early the next morning, just after dawn, to, actually pay a little Navy patrol boat of the Cambodian Navy to pay the crew to take us down there. Pran knew these people, had once done some work for this Cambodian Navy, and I hid out for 2 hours on a beach while he tracked down people who would help us get there. And we got there, and we saw what happened, and we saw the crematoriums and the smoke, and we saw the bodies, and it was what war is, a horror show, an insane, gruesome thing. And we were held overnight, and still got back with the story. There are a lot more details, but Pran was instrumental in that, and obviously I couldn't have done without him. And I think I can say honestly that one of the things that Pran represents is a negative on foreign correspondence, because we could never do our jobs as well,
mm-hmm.
nowhere near as well, without people like Pran. And we don't pay them homage. And we swan around afterwards saying, well, I got this award or I got that award, which is meaningless. When the Pulitzer was awarded for our coverage in 1976, I accepted on behalf of Pran and myself.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it is officially. It's Pran's its Prons Award as well.
Well, Sidney Shenberg, we mentioned that Dithprahn saved your life. After the Khmer Rouge took over Phnom Penh, you, Prahn, and a few other Western journalists were taken into custody. What happened?
Well, when they poured into the city, we didn't. We just felt we'd just go all over the city, as we usually do, and see what was going on. So one of the first, usually every day, we would go to either a refugee camp on the edge of the city or to a hospital to see the reality of what, of the damage, the human damage of the war. So we went to the biggest civilian hospital. People had poured in, and there was no medicine was short. There weren't sterile latex gloves. Some people simply died on the stone floors, bleeding to death. There was blood flowing down the stairs, and it was a scene from, you know, hell. In any case, we took pictures and talked to some of the nurses, and then started to leave. And when we started to leave, an armored personnel carrier, which had been captured by the Khmer Rouge, rolled into the hospital grounds, and men jumped out and put guns to our heads and our stomachs and so forth, and told us to get into this tank-like vehicle. And Prahn just kept chattering at them. And we didn't know what he was saying because he was speaking so fast. Finally, Prahn got in, and I asked him what was going on outside. He said, they told me to go away. They didn't want me. They wanted the tom-toms, the big people. They just wanted you. Mm. And I told him I was part of the group and I had to go. 20 minutes or so later, the thing came to a stop, the vehicle, and we were on the shore of the Mekong, with the sand sort of slanting down to the water. And as the back door opened, there were these two Khmer Rouge soldiers with their AK-47s pointed at us. And we thought we were done, you know, that they were just going to open up the minute we got outside and roll us into the river. And he just jumped out and looked around and found the man he assumed was the chief officer. And he was right, because they weren't wearing chevrons or any rank markings. And started chattering at him, saying that we weren't a danger to them and that we were just here to record their victory and on. And he just kept talking for another hour and a half. And they would sometimes tell him to shut up, and he didn't. And finally, he played a trick on them. He told the officer that we had heard over the radio in the morning when the Khmer Rouge took the radio station that they were going to allow journalists to work freely and to record this their seizure of Phnom Penh and the government and so forth. And there was no announcement on the radio.
Huh.
And that was it. And it was total bluff.
And that's something.
Anyway, so that's Prahn.
We're speaking with veteran journalist Sidney Shenberg about his friend and colleague Dithprahn. Prahn and Shenberg go way back to the killing fields of Cambodia. We'll have more with Sidney Shenberg after a quick break. And later in the show, we speak to the director of the new film Stop Loss. Stay with us here and now. Back now with veteran journalist Sidney Shenberg talking about his friend and colleague Dithprahn, who's gravely ill with pancreatic cancer. Dithprahn escaped the genocide in Cambodia in the 1970s. His story was eventually made into the movie The Killing Fields. And Sidney Shenberg, in 1975, you had to get out of Cambodia. Dithprahn couldn't leave. And for someone like him with education and connection to Westerners, that meant almost certain death at the hands of the communist Khmer Rouge who had taken over. So obviously that must have been very difficult for you. What was going on in your mind when you left him, this man who had saved your life?
I was crying, and I had my head against the building as they left, he and a small group of people. There was nothing we could do. We tried faking a passport for him. The French said that the Khmer Rouge would see it as a forgery and might kill a lot of people. It was clear that these people had no concern for our lives or anybody's lives. I mean, they really were dead behind the eyes, completely given over to this, you know, this extreme communist idea of an agrarian revolution.
Right.
And the French said, we can't risk it. So Prahn and a small group left a day early to try to, you know, I don't know, to be able to negotiate on their own. But he knew just what all of us knew about them, that they, what their rules were, what their attitude was toward educated people, and he just transformed himself into a taxi driver.
Well, how did he survive?
He started to speak in street language, not educated Khmer.
So is that how he survived? That's what I wanted to ask you.
Yes, he did. How he survived. He survived by negotiating and by sometimes simply by what everybody did, trying to catch an occasional frog or a lizard to eat instead of this half a small can of rice every day.
Hmm. And so while you're separated from him, what, it was 4 years or so?
4.5 years.
Did you assume he was dead during that period?
No, I did not. I refused to allow myself to think that, and that was true of his family, too, because we had evacuated the family with the American embassy 5 days before the Khmer Rouge took the city. And that's what he wanted. He wanted to stay himself. But I felt completely responsible and guilty, obviously, because the matter, he wouldn't have been in that position if not for me.
Hmm.
On the other hand, of course, he might have been just another Cambodian being herded out of the city. You know, 2 million people in a day were pushed out of that city. It was biblical, but gruesome. And anyway, so I didn't give up on him. No, what I did was I started searching for him through others and people I knew at the border and refugee camps, and I put out a reward for anybody that found information, and there were mercenaries up there who would go inside the country. It was closed off to the world.
Right. And how were you finally reunited? I've read and...
First of all, it was Prawn again who saw to it that he got word out. When the Vietnamese tired of fighting border battles with the Khmer Rouge, the Vietnamese army came in January 1979, and Prawn, during that period, on a particular day, saw a group of reporters who were brought in, Russian reporters, others from the Soviet Union, who were brought in to see what the Vietnamese were doing, brought in by the Vietnamese themselves. And Prawn just walked up to one of these gentlemen and said, I want you to take a message to somebody. He didn't know me, and he didn't know Prawn, and he didn't know the story. And he just, when he got back to Paris, he called me on the phone. And
wow.
He said he had taken a picture. Prawn asked him to take a picture, and he was mailing that to me.
You must have been overjoyed.
Yeah, that was the beginning of the miracle.
Hmm.
And before they could take any administrative action or seek any permissions, he had fled with a group of friends and headed for the Thai border. And when they got to the border, they were blocked. They had no papers. They had no money to give bribes. And it took another 10 days or so before Prawn wangled his way across the border and got to a refugee camp and singled out a missionary who was working in the camp and got word to me.
Wow.
And I took the next plane there.
Now, after he left Cambodia, he became a photojournalist, worked for the Times again,
right,
and dedicated his life to telling Cambodia's story. This really became his mission.
That was and is his mission.
Right. And in a very way, this will sort of be his legacy.
Is
he satisfied about that? As he struggles with cancer today?
Because he has told his family, and it's in writing, that he wants to do more through a foundation which is going to be set up. And he's asked us all to help, to help find sponsors and so forth and so on, to not just talk about Cambodia, but about genocide. But that's what he wants, and he still talks about it. His other mission now is to tell people to get checkups early. If they have some small problem, don't be afraid to get a CAT scan.
Hmm.
Push. That's our word, push. And
yeah.
He wants to tell everybody about his experiences and so that they don't suffer the same. And he's just a very open man. He says nothing to hide. Tell everybody everything. You know, he's a true reporter. I mean, and that's what he is.
Well, one thing for sure, he's a fighter. He's a survivor. You talked about him surviving the Khmer Rouge re-education camps as a miracle. Does he still think he can fight and survive this, or is he resigned to it's time to pass on?
Well, he is still fighting because he's not giving up. You know, you can Macron and I, you know, we have actually watched people die as they let go. He hasn't let go yet. But he said, God apparently doesn't want to take me yet.
Mm.
And, you know, and we talk about a lot of things. We talk about how we'll communicate later. And all sounds, to some people, may sound foolish, but we figure we don't know what's on the other side. And so Pran says, yes, we will, and I'll send you my dreams.
That's Sidney Shanberg, formerly of the New York Times, talking about his old friend and colleague, Dith Pran. Their story won a Pulitzer Prize and was made into the movie The Killing Fields. Sidney, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
And for more information on how to reach Dith Pran and his family, go to our website, here-now.org. You're listening to Here and Now. Here are some of the latest indications that the nation may be slipping into recession. Sales of new homes were down in February for a fourth straight month. Orders for big-ticket goods, like home appliances, fell for the second straight time. And overall, economic growth slowed to just 0.6% in the final 3 months of last year. But how can you tell if your hometown economy is about to go belly up? Here in Now's Barbara Howard visited one Massachusetts town where the number of foreclosures has tripled over the last year, and she discovered that the signs of a slowdown are not always that easy to spot.
Haverhill, Massachusetts is an old mill town on the Merrimack River. It went into a slump when the shoe factories closed decades ago. Since then, the huge post, beam, and brick buildings that ring downtown have been converted into upscale apartments, condos, and artist lofts. Tom Malin is a lifelong town resident and booster. He points out all the downtown businesses that have benefited from the influx.
This is a new cafe that just opened. There's a new restaurant right next to it that's open. This is another artist studio, lofts over here, that's all condo rental. And then you've got, when you get on the street,
yeah,
the railroad's right there. So that's what they're basing it on.
Oh, that you come up on the commuter rail?
Yes.
In and out of Boston?
Yes.
After 1 year on the market, the largest mill converted to apartments is now 97% occupied. Its tenants, many of them young couples and singles, are renting rather than buying the condos that are for sale nearby. Home loans for condos are hard to come by, and the market is keeping rental rates competitive. Each day, these new tenants make the walk through the brick and cobblestone downtown to catch the train to Boston. At night, the downtown is hopping. And with all that foot traffic, there are few signs of a slowdown here. There are a half dozen hair salons along the one-block stretch between the post office and the train station. Lauren Bocelli owns the Cutting Edge Studio and Spa. Her hair dryers are humming, and she says, so is business.
Since I purchased this in June of last year, the numbers have doubled since I purchased it. And a lot of new businesses are coming in. I haven't even had a chance to step out to even see them because I've been so busy here myself.
So what's happening here? At first glance, it's hard to see how the doom and gloom predictions about the economy are playing out in downtown Haverhill. With all the talk of recession, you'd think that people would be pinching pennies. Professor Barry Bluestone of Northeastern University in Boston studies economic trends. And while towns like Haverhill in the Northeast haven't been hit as hard as the Midwest, he believes change is on the horizon.
Offshore, there is this tsunami. There is this huge rogue wave coming at us. It will occur as the credit markets tighten still further and as the foreclosure rate rises, as we expected to do it. What we're seeing now is kind of the last gasp of people trying to maintain their standard of living. What will happen is that people are going to pull in their spending. They will be forced to do that.
Haircuts and dinners out, the kinds of small outlays you'd see on the main street, may be okay for now. But those first ripples, Bluestone says, are already lapping up against another indicator of how well the economy is or is not doing, sales of durable goods. And in Haverhill, people are now beginning to postpone big-ticket purchases like refrigerators, stoves, and washing machines.
Jason Kimball, call 215. Jason Kimball, 215.
On the outskirts of town next to the interstate, the home improvement megastore Lowe's has more red-aproned employees working the floor than customers. In the appliances department, the salesman stands alone. He tells me there's been very little foot traffic lately, and other employees agree. Todd, a contractor who would only give his first name, says that he's here today just killing time, looking but not buying, because he says his business is hurting.
In the last 6 months, it's definitely slowed down. But I think people are just waiting to see what's going to happen. You know, hopefully interest rates come down a little bit more and they'll stop putting some money back into the houses, but we'll see what happens in the spring. Hopefully it'll pick up.
At the plumbing supply company he manages in Haverhill, Derek Gandolfo sees a lot less of contractors like Todd. Gandolfo estimates 85% of area plumbers are looking for work, so he's not surprised that sales of optional upgrades like whole house air conditioners have fallen with the drop in housing values. What he does find alarming is the drop in the sales of another big-ticket item, one far more essential in harsh New England winters, furnace boilers. Gandolfo says homeowners are opting to repair rather than replace.
They fix them a lot more than they would. You know, before it would cost maybe $500 to fix the boiler, they put a new one in. Now they just fix it.
With these big-ticket items backing up in the warehouse, Gandolfo's company is cutting back.
2 years ago, we had about 14 guys working in the warehouse. We're down to 9. I've been here 6 years. I've never seen layoffs. I actually bought a house a year ago, and probably a few months after, I lost all my overtime since I bought that house.
How many extra overtime hours were you pulling about a year ago?
It was 5 to 10 hours a week.
How much money would that be for you, roughly?
Last year, I lost around a little over $8,000.
Now Gandolfo, like his customers, is cutting back on his own spending. And it snowballs, says Professor Bluestone.
And all of a sudden the bank tells me, your house isn't worth what it was worth last year. It's fallen by 7%. You have less equity. I can't give you a loan. So all of a sudden, instead of getting a 6% loan on home equity, I'm paying 18% on my credit card. I look around and I turn to my wife and I say, honey, let's cut back here and let's keep the car another year.
And even if they're buying a new car, it's a smaller one. At the Haverhill Ford dealership, salesman Tom Greeno says people are trading down, getting rid of their gas guzzlers, and that is helping sales figures. But the price of gas is just one thing moving the cars off the lot. Profit margins are shrinking as Ford offers all kinds of buyer incentives.
There's been a lot coming from Ford, you know, with the rebates and low interest rates, and there's some really good lease programs out there now. A little more than usual right now. I think they're kicking it up because of the downturn. They're trying to, you know, keep ahead of the curve a little bit by keeping people buying and in the market.
And keeping people buying can be tricky these days, even for people with secure jobs. People like Professor Bluestone. His job is tenured, but he says even he will cut back on spending if he has to go to a bank for a home equity loan to pay down credit card debt, or if he sees his investments dwindle.
If you keep track of your portfolio, and all of a sudden you see the value of your home or your portfolio decline sharply, you may still have your job, you may still be getting a paycheck every Friday, but you feel much poorer. It's only paper loss, but you feel poorer. Well, if you get to that point where everybody sees their wealth declining, then people begin to just naturally cut back because they feel less wealthy.
And that, says Bluestone, can lead to a real recession, no matter where you live.
It isn't as though all of a sudden these things just happen. It's not like a switch. It begins to roll, and as it picks up momentum, it can get very bad then very quickly.
That's economist Barry Bluestone. Our snapshot of how Haverhill, Massachusetts is faring in a changing economy was produced by Here and Now's Barbara Howard. You're listening to Here and Now. Okay, time now to talk about all those brackets again and all those tall, rangy college kids running around in circles, shooting and throwing elbows at each other. That's right, it's March Madness, which tips off again tonight and tomorrow with regional semifinal games in the men's tournament. The women play their regional semifinals Saturday and Sunday. Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game, joins us now to talk about the tournaments and the rest of the week's sports. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Anthony.
So, tell us how your bracket is looking. Last week, as I recall, you were pretty satisfied with your record.
Well,
how's it going?
Let me just put it this way. The intern in the mailroom who based his picks on the relative ferocity of the mascots of the various teams is ahead of me now. Maybe we can just leave it at that.
All right, fair enough. So there have been some upsets in the men's tournament, but all the top seeds have advanced
right.
to the regionals, right?
Right, right. Yeah, there have been some upsets, and of course the upsets created some intriguing and unlikely matchups. Number one, Kansas playing number 12, Villanova, for example. Number three, Wisconsin playing number 10, Davis, and a number one UCLA playing number 12, Western Kentucky. I'm afraid that the outcomes in each case are probably predetermined, but should any of those long shots advance, it would certainly create some interesting situations later in the tournament.
So other than that unlikely event, don't expect big surprises in the Final Four?
I don't think so at this point, no. excuse me. I think that the distance between the very best teams and the pretenders is pretty demonstrable.
And what about the women's tournament? What can we look forward to?
Well, there it's even more demonstrable. All four number one seeds, all four number two seeds are successfully through to this point. No real surprises. A couple of number sixes knocked off a couple of number threes. Baylor went out early, which was a bit of a surprise, I guess, to some people. They won the championship not so long ago. The great thing to look forward to, of course, in the women's tournament is the potential final, Tennessee against Connecticut. It's not a sure thing, of course, but should it happen, it would be fraught with all sorts of magnificent baggage because the coaches of those teams, Connecticut's Gino Auriemma, Tennessee's Pat Summitt, are no longer speaking to each other. They don't play each other anymore in the regular season. There's something going on here, and neither one of them is willing to tell us exactly what it is. Each one says the other can talk about it if he or she wishes to. So that would be a game that transcends basketball by the time it's finally played, if it is.
A little bit of Peyton Place there.
Absolutely.
Okay. So, Bill, let's move to Major League Baseball, and apparently the season started this week. We know this in Boston, of course, because the Red Sox played two games against Oakland in Japan.
Somewhere over there, 13 time zones away, right?
Yeah. Do most fans even realize that the baseball season has started?
It's an interesting question, Anthony. I was approached by one fan who was upset because the Red Sox lost Game 2 before he had a chance to read about the result of Game 1 in the Globe. He's one of these people who gets the later edition of the Globe. It does create a very strange sort of situation. I'm sure there were some people who enjoyed going to bars and eating cornflakes and scrambled eggs at 6 o'clock in the morning while they watched the Red Sox play. Very interesting thing to happen in terms of it being a novelty. I would hate to see it become a regular part of the season.
Is this just pure and simple getting the brand, the MLB brand, over to Japan, or is there something else going on?
I think that's exactly what it is. Major League Baseball is involved in the globalization just as any other business tries to. They're trying to not only expand their influence into Japan, where baseball is already a big deal, but also into places like England and Germany and South Africa, where people don't know baseball from beanbags. But there are people who will apparently wear caps and buy jackets there as well.
Finally, Bill, the sport that's closest to your heart, soccer. Major League Soccer kicks off its regular season this weekend, and the Houston Dynamo are the defending champions, mm-hmm. if I have that right. You can correct me if I don't. Can you give us a quick preview of this coming season?
Well, the New England Revolution, will probably beat the Houston Dynamo in the opening game because it isn't, after all, the championship game, and that's the only one that the Revolution can be counted on to lose. I hate to say that, and I hope it will be different this year. I'm sure it'll be an intriguing system. They tell me David Beckham is healthy this time around, and he's just enjoyed his 100th appearance for the national team in England. So there are all sorts of things to look forward to.
All right. Well, we'll stay tuned with your help. Thanks. Bill Littlefield hosts NPR's Only a Game every weekend. Thanks, Bill.
Thank you.
After a break, the film Stop Loss examines the toll of repeated deployments to Iraq. That's coming up here and now. The number of U.S. troops in Iraq is expected to stay at 140,000 until President Bush leaves office or longer. That's about the same number of troops that have been there since before last year's surge. The need to maintain this larger force in Iraq, as well as more troops in Afghanistan, continues to put a strain on the military to retain qualified troops. The new film Stop Loss dramatizes the impact of one of the policies the military relies upon to maintain its troop numbers. Here and Now producer Emiko Tamagawa brings us this story.
For her follow-up to her much-acclaimed 1999 film Boys Don't Cry, writer and director Kimberly Pierce decided to focus on the effect of the war on the soldiers who fight it.
We knew that it was going to be about a patriotic young man, Brandon Leonard King, who signed up for all the right reasons, to defend his country, his home, and his family. He's celebrated as a war hero. He wants to get back to his life, and he wants to put this experience behind him.
But Brandon Leonard King, played in the film by Ryan Phillippe, can't put the experience behind him. When he reports for what he thinks will be his discharge, Brandon finds out he's going to be sent back to Iraq for another tour of duty. Because the military still needs him, Brandon's service has been extended without his consent or knowledge. It's a policy that's known as stop loss. As we hear in this scene, it's news that outrages both King and his mother.
They stop lost you? How can they do this?
They're doing whatever they want to do. With a shortage of guys and no draft, they're shipping back soldiers who're supposed to be getting out. It's a backdoor draft is what it is.
That outrage, and the belief that stop-loss is a way of the military doing a draft without actually doing a draft, is something that Kimberly Pierce heard from the soldiers that she interviewed in putting together the film. Though Pierce has a personal interest in the military, her younger brother volunteered for the Army right after 9/11, it was another soldier that she interviewed whose instant message gave her the focus and the title of her film.
He said, "Do you want to hear something effed up?" And I said, "What?" And he put on, "I am. Stop loss." And what I found most interesting was this patriotic soldier, who wasn't necessarily pro-war, anti-war, but was doing his job, said, "This is really wrong." So then I started going down the road of interviewing patriotic soldiers. "Why'd you sign up?" "I signed up for patriotic reasons." "How do you feel now?" "I'm really angry. How could I be being stop loss? I've already done my time." They also said they were shouldering an unfair burden of this war.
And as Kimberly Pierce learned through her research, dropping enlistment rates meant that stop loss has affected tens of thousands of troops over the past 5 years, many of whom were sent back for second or third tours of duty. But as we hear in this scene with Brandon, his mother, and his best friend Steve's fiancée, Michelle, every soldier's case is different.
What about Steve?
Mitch, I don't know. Some of us are getting it, some ain't.
This cannot be happening. No, you almost died over there. What do you want to do? You want me to take you to Mexico till this blows over?
No. Out of the question, Mom. I ain't dragging my tail across to Mexico.
But though he doesn't initially want to go to Mexico, go AWOL, as soldiers have done, Brandon knows he doesn't want to go back to Iraq. Stop loss follows him as he and Michelle cross the country looking for a way out for Brandon. We also see the effects of the war on Brandon's comrades. They suffer severe physical injuries, post-traumatic stress disorder, alcoholism, and divorce. I asked Pierce if she felt the need to put in as many of the effects of the war as she could.
Well, I felt a real responsibility to get it right. And believe me, there were stories that were much, much worse in terms of what was happening to soldiers. But I didn't want to tip the scale too much either way. I wanted it to be representative of what a number of soldiers are going through so that it really showed, first of all, that they're signing up for patriotic reasons, second of all, that they're fighting for survival and camaraderie, and that they're coming home and they are struggling with reassimilation, that it can be difficult, but that they all have this real desire to be together with their men and to be together with their family. That, to me, was my obligation, was to get inside that desire.
The desire to get together with their families is something that, of course, gets put on hold as soldiers have been stop-lost, a prospect that makes Michelle uncertain about her own future with Steve.
I can't go another year without having him touch my face. I can't be a military wife. I just ain't that strong.
Kimberly Pierce's first film, Boys Don't Cry, was the story of Brandon Tina, the transgender teen who was murdered when his friends discovered that though he was living as a man, he had been born Tina Brandon, a girl. Though Brandon King, the hero of Stop Loss, had very different circumstances, both King and Tina are outsiders. Brandon's choices forced him away from what he'd thought was his home all of his life. I asked Kimberly Pierce if there was something about the idea of home that drew her.
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think I'm very drawn to stories about the American family, stories about characters who feel these strong emotional needs and find a certain truth within themselves. So Brandon Tina was an outsider who wanted to be an insider. right? So he was doing anything he could to try to fit into that straight culture that would allow him to get the girl, be in the trailer park, be in love, get acceptance. Brandon King is an insider who becomes an outsider in a way. He's the ultimate patriot. He's the ultimate leader. He's the ultimate guy who believes in camaraderie. And, you know, the circumstances that he gets thrown into make him begin to think like an outsider.
Not only to think like an outsider, but Brandon King, the soldier from Brazos, Texas, who swore he'd never go to Mexico at the beginning of the film, by its end is at the border, thinking about what crossing it will mean for the rest of his life.
Cross that border? Ain't gonna be me coming up the other side, Mitch. It's gonna be the ghost of me.
Brandon, please.
And never the ranch. Never you and Dad, never Brazos. This war ain't never gonna be behind me.
Leaving the war behind is something that audiences seem to want to do. Despite big-name stars in the leads, dramatic films about Iraq such as In the Valley of Elah and Rendition have done poorly at the box office. Could Stop Loss be any different? Kimberly Pierce thinks so, based on the response she's gotten from pre-release screenings of the film that she's gone to around the country.
What's amazing to me is people come up to me after the screening and they say, thank you for making such an emotional movie. Thank you for telling me a story that I'm curious about that I haven't seen. I think the other thing is this movie was completely born out of soldiers' experiences. Me interviewing these soldiers, talking to my brother, and the videos that my brother brought home that I then went and collected with my research partner, Reed Carolyn. We have all these videos that soldiers shot when they were in combat, put the camera on the sandbag, put the camera on the gun turret, put the camera on the Humvee. These boys were, and women, because they're also doing it, but mostly the boys that I was interviewing, are capturing their experiences, and then which is already unadulterated, and then they're editing it so it's their fantasy of themselves, it's a letter home, it's a letter to their loved one. So I think that unlike these other, I don't know about these other movies, because I really support my other filmmakers, so I don't really want to be comparing, but to me this is like coming out of the soldier's experience, and it's very much the internet generation. This is the generation that has cameras, that films, and that shares it and posts it. So I feel like this is coming from a place that's not only from the soldier, but also from kind of where our world is at right now, and that's why it's so important that those videos are in the movie, because that's how soldiers are communicating.
Kimberly Pierce has also received positive, if also somewhat surprising, feedback from her studio, Paramount Pictures.
We were very lucky at the last screening. You know, the studio was said, congratulations. And I was like, okay. They said, you made a commercial movie. And I'm like, great. You know, what did you think I had made? They said, no, you made a commercial movie. You got the over 25 and the under 25 men and women. And, you know, they said, you're speaking to a young audience. And I said, that's great. That's, you know, this is this generation's conflict, this generation's war. And I think it's going to be this generation's legacy.
Stop Loss, the movie, opens in theaters tomorrow.